talk, I guess, might end very abruptly if that little thing saying please replace the lamp becomes relevant. I assume that was a positive development. So the work I wanted to talk about today is work done in collaboration with my doctoral student Sergei Saavedra in Oxford in the engineering department and Brian Lutze in Northwestern. And it's been very good fortuitous planning how the talks have been scheduled, given that the last one was about preferential attachment and growing networks, because that also in some sense takes care of some of the things that that I was going to at least very briefly address. I guess the other contrast to Sid's talk is that there was some very elegant formal tools shown, and there's been a lot of work on network growth, agglomeration process, and so on. There has been relatively little work on contracting networks, and so that's really an area we're still looking for tools, and in particular analytic tools. What I will largely be talking about here are simulation results and empirical results, although we are now starting to actually produce some analytic results as well, but it's really too early days to present anything on that. And so in a quick picture, what I'm going to be talking on is actually encapsulated on this front slide, which is an empirical network which at T0 ends up, is in the way you see it on your left, the sort of rich fuzz ball of whatever is going on there, and at the end of the period we have data on has been reduced to the thing that you see on the right. And I'm not going to say anything at all about this, except precisely because you've heard a lot about attachment mechanisms and growing networks in the last talks and in other talks. And so this is mainly by way of setup, by saying we have, we might argue about what sort of attachment mechanisms are appropriate to what sort of growing network systems. But certainly there's a range of mechanisms ranging from preferential attachment to combinations of random attachment, random walk, to fitness, to duplication, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, most of the empirically well-characterized and studied systems are systems of growth, although recently people have started looking much more also at networks of finite and static size. And so the question, in some sense, is just to set up the more general problem before looking at something quite specific. Is network contraction a sort of odd thing, or might network contraction be more generic if hence worth studying? Now, one area where certainly people are aware of the importance of network contraction is in ecological networks, looking at things like habitat fragmentation, habitat loss, collapse restoration processes, and so on. So certainly there's theoretical work on that, and it is acknowledged to be important. What, of course, is very difficult is empirically, when one looks at things like food web data, that's not you do not have a time series data that allows you to see how dynamically this evolves over time. There are a few exceptions. I forget, some colleges told me about some, sounds to me like a rather unethical experiment where they introduced foreign species in the lake and then basically afterwards killed off everything. And this was done in the 70s, and I'm sure this could no longer be done. But certainly if you're interested in sort of evolution, then that's very difficult, although it's acknowledged to be important. People like David Stark of Columbia have argued that if one is thinking about economic networks in former communist countries, and you're looking at the sort of transition economies and how they transition to capitalism, then actually declining networks play a very important role as well. And then you can make sort of hand-wavy arguments about decline collapse of civilizations, or perhaps slightly more solid arguments about decline and growth of trade routes, sort of stuff that, for instance, Doug White has looked at to a certain extent. And then finally, you could argue that as you switch out of one type of infrastructure network or supply network or communication network to another because of changing technology. Of course, there's one network that's growing, but there's also another one that's declining. So just very broadly, a suggestion that it might be worth looking at network contraction and decline, not only because of the particular case that I'll be talking about, but also because it might actually characterize a more general problem set with important features. And I'll come back. So what are we, what am I going to be looking at empirically? What I'm looking at empirically is the New York garment industry. Since this comes from a picture that Science ran in the news story about this work, and that's a picture they put up of the New York garment industry, and since it's Science, that must be the New York garment industry, so I thought I'd put it down as well. Now, it would be nice to say that what we wanted to do was think about contracting networks, and then we went out and found a nice example of a contracting network and started working on it. Of course, that's a complete myth. What happened is we got a very interesting data set. We discovered that one of the characteristics of this data set was that there was severe contraction in this, and that started us thinking about that. So what are we talking about in general terms? We're talking about firms largely geographically in New York City, although the data set actually includes firms in much of the East Coast. So certainly if a firm moves from, say, New York to New Jersey, that doesn't mean you would lose it. And one of the characteristics of garment industry and production is that there are many manufacturers that do very little in-house manufacturing. And what they do instead is they essentially coordinate a whole range of processes, from cutting fabrics to attaching things to sewing things, et cetera, et cetera. And so they are involved with a whole set of contractors doing specific jobs, and they're coordinating how things move back and forth between them. And so in some sense, that defines a set of local relations for joint production, joint problem solving, joint production of the products that they'll eventually sell. Now, the reason in this diagram certain of the players are represented in gray is that those are the bits that we don't actually see in our data. So what we see in the data is essentially everything in this sort of multicolored quadrant up here. We don't have data on essentially the raw sourcing and the original materials, so that would be the textile mills going to the converters, which feeds into the manufacturing process. And equally well, we don't actually have in our data set anything about retailers, so that's things like, I guess, Bloomingdale's or department stores who would actually buy this. So we don't see the complete network. What we essentially see is this production network. And I'll say a few more things. I mean, there are other sorts of things that we're missing as well. The other thing, obviously, is that because it's a geographically defined data set, if, for instance, a firm were to move overseas or something like that, then for all intents and purposes, it vanishes. So we wouldn't be able to distinguish between a firm going bankrupt and a firm moving out of region. And this is actually how the data originally looked. The data became a lot richer as we've been working on it, and that's almost been a problem in the sense that we defined what we thought would be interesting originally in terms of what we had. It's very unusual to be able to look in this global way at a supply chain involving many, many firms, many different players, and over a substantive period of time be able to track them. And that's because the firms themselves are probably only going to know who they're interacting with directly. Very often they don't think that this is data worth keeping, etc. We've tried to find equivalent data for other industries and so on, and I found that's virtually impossible. The reason that this data exists is that the union, first of all, it's a highly unionized industry, so well over 90% of firms in the industry are unionized, and levels of unionization have not declined. And the union actually keep records of the transactions between the firms. And the reason they do this is ultimately they use that to work out membership dues. But because they're obviously somewhat concerned about not getting correct figures, they actually almost collect raw data. So we have, in January, firm A paid firm B so much, we will have that recorded. There's a certain amount of coarse grainedness in the sense that obviously there'll be a lumping of certain transactions, but one can see transactions down to the 1 month level in some sense. And the other thing is that for reasons that have nothing to do with research, this is considered to be by sociologists and people who know the industry far better than I because not only do the unions go and check the books of the firms to make sure to see what the amounts are, but they actually have people on the streets sort of counting bales of material and trying to sort of check up on what's going on. And so obviously we're missing that small proportion of the firms that are non-unionized, and we're missing the firms that are out of geography, but within the set it is empirically a very good data set, which now extends over almost 20 years. We've decided not to use the last 2 years of the data we have because of some things we're still trying to check up on. And in principle, the nature of the data, I mean, the main thing the data includes is essentially gross transactions between different firms. If you see that the firm paying to and paying from is the same, that's not a mistake. It means that's a cost associated with some internal manufacturing process. And we have, originally, this is essentially the nature of the data we had. Now, in addition to having these 20 years, what we have is geographic location, so you could look at spatial proximity effects, which we haven't yet done. You can look at ownership relationships, so you know who owns whom. You have information on the CEOs of these companies. So you know the sector they're in, because essentially the garment industry segmented into different things, sportswear, this, that, the next thing. So in fact, we now have much more fine-grained information on this than when we started this project. Let me get to the next app, yes. And so what one can do is essentially take this data set and construct a network from it. And the things to think about in doing so are, first of all, how one wants to construct that network, and second of all, and the second key thing is, in some sense, what this network means, in the sense that it's quite clear what the relevance is if I, for instance, pay for some material, but in some sense, what does it mean to be the next nearest neighbor in the network? So what sense is the network relevant? So starting with the first question, in principle, of course, you have all the information you need to construct a directed and weighted network. You might wish to argue which way the directionality should run. Is it the cash flows? Is it the material flows? And the weights, again, there are, you could, for instance, decide that the transaction amount is a good proxy for weight, but there are arguments, just because I've paid somebody off doesn't mean necessarily there's a strong relationship. It might be that frequency of interactions is a better way of weighting. So there's different ways one could weight, and in principle one has information that could be construed as a directed and weighted network. One of the ways of trying to figure out what to do, I mean, the first thing obviously was that we thought we might as well start by analyzing this as a binary, an undirected binary network, to see where that gets us, simply because that's the simplest starting point. But there is also a sensible motivation for that, and that is, it depends ultimately what you think this network is about. I mean, is it some sort of, I have here, so this is the picture from Mark's talk. This is the work on collaboration networks, which is Gregory Mark Newman did. So should we be thinking of this as some kind of a social collaboration network, which would be in line with sort of Granovetter's notions of social embeddedness and things like that? Or, on the other hand, should we be thinking of this as some sort of network of resource flows? This is something in our group, something completely different, biological system, looking essentially at transports of nutrients in a fungal network. So, and obviously, if one's talking about transports and directed, if one's thinking about this, then directedness is perhaps not so important. If one's thinking about specific transporting resources, then it is. So, as I say, one could motivate looking at the undirected network initially by saying, well, what's interested in is social interactions between the firms in this network. Or one could simply say, well, that's perhaps a simple starting point, and then we could try to put in more structure afterwards. And the key observation is essentially this one, that you start in 1985 with well over 3,000 firms, and by the time you've reached 2003, you've got under 200 firms. So that is a population reduction of over an order of magnitude. And having talked to economists and sociologists, it corresponds to, and it is in some sense a real effect, so it's not just a concentration effect. It's not just that more and more economic activity gets concentrated in fewer and fewer players. It is also that the overall economic activity declines significantly, of course, in this New York garment industry sector, not in the garment industry globally. And a lot of that is obviously shifting capacity to cheap labor markets overseas. There are also arguments about more idiosyncratic reasons, things like high rent levels and so on. So this is a very real effect. And the good thing about this talk is it even gives you a free eye test. If you look at what's happening at the firm level, the system is actually extremely volatile. So, for instance, you start here with these 3,250 firms, roughly, and then you lose in the next year about 800 of them, but then you also get roughly 500 new entrants. So you both have a high level of attrition, but you also have a high level of new entry. And those people who work on things like organizational ecology would find that typically surprising, because the typical assumption is that if you're looking at a declining industry or a declining system, then actually new entry will be significantly suppressed. I mean, the system is declining because essentially at every point the number of firms deleted exceeds the number of new entrants, but there are new entrants all the way through. And similarly, you see lots of fluctuations in link dynamics, and links can obviously be, one way of looking at this is by saying links could be deleted in two possible ways. First of all, a link might vanish if the firm it's associated with vanishes. But then again, you can also have links deleted between firms that remain in the set. So you can have deletion of links between incumbents that remain in the set. And you can also have, obviously you have new entrants who will then bring new links into the network, but you also observe that new links are formed between incumbents already in the set. So, clearly, yes?
Why does the number of firms change between 94 and 95 stay even?
This probably has a lot to do with people holding back, and then it has to do with NAFTA largely. So if you think about exogenous shocks that are important for the garment industry, NAFTA is quite important.
Yeah, but the number of
there is, it is very much slowed down, but that's a typo. Sorry, it's not that the number of firms remains exactly identical. But it is actually, I know why the typo must have happened. It's quite close. It's remarkably close, and we kind of wondered why this was. Yeah?
So why don't you start from 2003 and go backwards in time, and then it's growth instead of...
Okay, so I mean, so one question is, okay, one question one could come to is this, you know, under time reversal, would this be symmetric in a way? So if you do that, you know, does it look the same? So I mean, I think we'll be coming to that. So that's then related to, is it reasonable to assume that assembly and disassembly look the same under time reversal?
Do you know how many of the new firms result from an old firm splitting into two?
No. What we do know is that mergers are rare, because we checked that. But what you don't see, you can check that, well, unless they are under the same ownership, you don't know. So in some sense, if a firm demerges and they become completely separate, independent entities, then, so if it's a sort of fragmentation process, then you wouldn't know. Which is, and one of the models actually from biology that we're playing around with a bit is a sort of coalescence fragmentation model to try to recover some of these things. But the problem is, empirically, you don't actually know. what these fragmentations look like. So looking just at, yes, and one of these won't make sense until we've seen the next slide, looking at just some of the overall network metrics, so things like percentage of firms in the joint component. I mean, one of the things you can obviously observe is that most of the firms to start with actually sit in the joint component of the network. And the decline is given an order of magnitude decline in number of firms in the population of type wild. And then looking at things like average connectivity, a degree distribution, path length, diameter. And this is an exponent that will make sense in a moment. Rearranging the slides doesn't make sense because you can see that over this time, you have a very clear scaling relationship between the number of firms and the number of links, with an exponent of about 1.2. So one of the main, and this is a, we have a nicer plot, which I couldn't find, so this is a slightly messier plot. So one of the interesting things we observed is, if you look at the degree distribution, well, in this case specifically the human degree distribution, and you look at it year by year, what you find is that it certainly is a broad scale distribution. And if you want to fit something parallel like with an exponential cutoff to it, and do the usual maximum likelihood and so on, you find that, that essentially this year has an exponent around 5 halves. Cutoff varies. And the main thing, I'm in no way now going to try to make it leave these straight lines or that, but the main point is in some sense that over much of this period of what, after all, was extremely significant contraction, this remains quite stable. And it then breaks up in the final years, but what you have, you know, one of the things one must bear in mind, of course, is that finite size effects become quite significant as we're getting down to a quite small system in the end. So, and to a certain extent, this is something we hadn't expected. So in some sense, the standard stories about how you get essentially stable degree distributions would suggest you need a growing network, or at least a network of finite size under very particular conditions. So we were very surprised that essentially this distribution remains so stable, given the amount of loss going on here. So that's one of the sort of features we observed and we're interested about. The other thing that we looked at is the disassortative structure using Maslow's modularity analysis. So very much a tool that's been used to look at things like the internet, which mainly the point is that it identifies typically if you look at links whether the structure is assortative, i.e. Nodes of a particular degree are likely to link to a node more or less the same sort of degree, or if they're disassortative, i.e. that high degree, low degree nodes are linked. And the way the plot, and this then compares it to a suitable random reference network, and it's done over, I think we did this with about 1,000 simulations. And one of the features that one sees certainly is that there's an over-representation, which is this red color, of very low degree nodes to very high degree nodes. And also there seems to be the sort of intermediate to intermediate, which is this blue stuff here, seems to be suppressed. So certainly there seems to be something about this disassortative destruction of the network. In discussing this with Brian Rutsi, who knows the industry well, and when he initially started on this research, actually was doing it much more qualitatively in terms of talking to people in the industry, interviewing, his feeling was that the reason you might have, and we'll see in a moment that this is quite persistent, these disassortative links, is that sole source suppliers can be cultivated, which simply means that if you have a supplier who you think provides you with very high quality goods, you might lock them into a favorable agreement for them on the condition that they don't supply to anyone else. as some sort of long-term relationship. And certainly there's kind of qualitative evidence on the ground that's certainly anecdotally what happens. So that, in some sense, could be the sort of a sociological motivation why one might see something like that. Yeah?
These are heterogeneous terms, right? So some of them are manufacturing,
yeah.
Some of them are... So
at the moment, and we will disaggregate that later on. So at the moment, yes, everything is lumped together. Although you will find that, if you sort of break it up into an almost bipartite network of, say, suppliers and manufacturers, then that doesn't break up. It is not necessarily, it doesn't break up that way. But yes, I mean, at this point, one of the things I didn't say when I said what is a simplification made is one important simplification made at this level of analysis is that everything's lumped into this generic category of firms. No? Yes. And so there's some stuff here that we're not sure exactly what's going on. I mean, one of the things you can certainly see is that these highly disassortative links persist over time. So essentially, if you do this analysis and see how the network evolves over time, you certainly find that this persists. We're not really quite sure why you get, in this particular, this overrepresentation of these sort of, these are typically 5 to 5, 6 to 6, somewhere between 5 to 5 to 10 to 10. In terms of disassortivity, we're not quite sure what that is about. But certainly, so the feature from this that we're kind of focusing on is that.
What would happen if you take the difference between scale between one year and the other?
Haven't done that also because it's difficult to see visually here because the scale slightly shifts.
Yeah.
Haven't done that. So haven't looked at the differences in this. So might actually have a look at that. So just based on, so in some sense extracting from these purely empirical observations of one particular network, the observation first of all that there seems to be a certain stability of certain network characteristics despite this large decline. And thinking so what mechanisms initially inspired entirely by this particular empirical example could one perhaps put in? And luckily the next slide is entirely superfluous because of course we've heard all about that previously. So I won't say much about, I'm amused to see a very similar set of names down here. This in fact is, and here I've just written the version down with an offset parameter to generalize it. This here is the actual data we get when we look at how newcomer firms, because if we're talking about, there is of course an attachment process that's going on here as well. And that attachment process is, as you saw, there's a not inconsiderable level of entry each year. Those firms come in and have to attach to the existing network. And that seems to very much follow preferential attachment. And if one wants, one could make, in the sociological literature, people would often motivate this by, like Joel Podolny with arguments about status or something like that, so that the degree of a node signals something. That argument doesn't seem very plausible when you're thinking about existing links and how you want to break them up. So leaving aside all the arguments about preferential attachment, I can see, at least heuristically, why it might be sensible to say that if I have incomplete information and I'm looking for something to attach, then the degree of a node gives me a proxy. But if I'm already attached to that node, then the argument in reverse seems to be a lot weaker. So what we have essentially looked at then is, here we're now thinking about, so I told you about the newcomer nodes, and those seem to follow preferential attachment reasonably well. So now we're interested in essentially in processes that only involve incumbent nodes, because we're thinking about processes through which links are lost. obviously, nodes that haven't yet entered the set cannot lose links because they have to first attach. And there's essentially two processes that are that operate. The one is simply that node A and node B may be connected by a link, and that link could be lost. And the second process, which is essentially a rewiring process, is that the link between node A and node B might be broken and reallocated to another node. And so what we look here, and this is very much using the sort of same approach that Alex Vasquez is using, we look essentially at the conditional probability that a node with, say, k links in year t will lose k minus 1 links in year t plus 1. And so that's the loss process. Similarly, we look at the conditional probability that a node with k links in year t will gain. And gain here means by reallocating, by rewiring an existing link, k plus reallocated links in year t plus 1. And then by summing this over k minus, summing this over k plus, we get the average number of links lost and the average number of links gained, which are plotted over here, which deviate as you go down in k from purely proportional behavior in the following sense, that it appears that, I would just say they deviate. We'll see what happens in a moment. There's clearly a deviation both in terms of links lost and in terms of links reallocated from proportional behavior. The sum total process is pretty much proportional if you put everything together. And in order to understand, I mean, in some sense, inspired by the fact that the observation that this is a highly disassorted network, what we've done is we've defined this very crude measure of a level of disassortivity. And what we find is, and in some sense the key plot is actually the much less legible inset rather than the bigger thing, is that we find that the likelihood of a link persisting varies exponentially with this level of disassortivity. And so highly disassortative links are much more likely to persist than assortative links or links with a low level of. And so that's one of the main things that in the simulation model, so this is purely, everything I've said so far is purely based on looking at the empirical data and the analysis of the empirical data. And so now what we're doing as a sort of first step is trying to simply incorporate these various empirical observations in a kind of simulation model that I guess in some ways might remind one in kind of reverse way of the extended Barabasi model or something like that. And the ingredients really all come from the empirically observed behavior. So the first observation is that node deletion is given by this sort of fitness function, which simply reflects the fact, and this could very well be a size proxy effect, that low degree nodes are much more likely to than high degree nodes. So in some sense you could say this is almost like this is like anti-targeted attack, if you think in terms of the sort of typical targeted attack phrasing. It's exact reverse of that. And now what you do is essentially you want to incorporate this observation that you want a mechanism which selectively prefers links with higher levels of disassortivity. And so what you do is you essentially, in order to decide, so the options are that a link could persist. So here is your network, say, type T, and then thinking about transitions to T plus 1, either the link can persist, it can be dropped altogether, or it can be rewired, which for various reasons here is called switch. And the probability of sticking or switching is drawn from this empirically given exponential distribution, which is related to the disassortative level. And then the final process is simply the process that was observed. So you delete nodes, you get rid of links, in a way that favors disassociative links. And then finally, you add in newcomers, and that happens preferentially simply because that seems to pretty much approximate to what the empirical data shows. The connectivity of the newcomers here is drawn from the distribution rather than being fixed. And so, all in all, what you're looking at here, just pictorially, is you've got the selective node deletion process, which is a kind of a trivial thing because, in a way, it's selectively deleting the nodes that a priori you would guess already are least likely to change things, but that simply reflects empirically what's happening. Then comes this process whereby based on the level of disassortivity and that exponential function, you decide whether or not to break the link, and that essentially ensures that both disassortative links are preferentially preserved in the breaking process, and also because of in the nature of the rewiring process, because the link with a higher degree holds on to a link and it then gets rewired randomly, and because low degree nodes are the largest part of the proportion, the rewiring process again is most likely to generate disassortative links. And then you've got this preferential attachment mechanism, pretty standard preferential attachment mechanism at the end. And initially, just sort of looking at the empirics and the simulation, what you find is if you use this model to determine how you remove links, and for instance, use different forms of random link removal mechanisms, then you find that this reproduces in terms of the cumulative degree distribution, the broad scale distribution that you found, whereas this is indistinguishable using standard statistical tests from the exponential distribution. You also find that various other measures you reproduce by following this model, which in some sense is perhaps not so surprising because after all you're simply implementing empirically observed or hypothesized mechanisms, you find that you reproduce reasonably well the disassortivity structure here, and also you can look at measures like path lengths. There's some average path lengths, and there's some other measures I don't have up here that are reproduced reasonably well, which are reproduced quite well by the model and not at all well by alternatives. The thing that is perhaps of more general interest was of more general interest to us is if you look at, and this is simply in order to make it comparable to preceding work, if you look at sort of one of the standard robustness metrics, so completely correlation theory type measure, you look at percentage of firms from the giant component. The interesting observation here is that, so the empirical case, which is this dotted line here, we saw that we started with something like 95% of the firms in the giant component and ended up with roughly 85%. So given that we've lost order of magnitude of the firms data set, actually, not much change. That is replicated reasonably well, not in detail, but reasonably well by the model. Alternatives are much, much, much worse and lead to quite rapid fragmentation. And the alternatives here are the black thing is a reasonably close, minus some technical details, to reversing preferential attachment, which among other things would also imply that you would be more likely to kill off disassortative links if you run that backwards and assortative links. And that actually fragments very quickly. Various types of random deletion processes fragment very quickly. And this is really, in this particular case, it's not very sensible, but simply because usually that's in and it guides the eye. If you think about targeted deletion, then that obviously leads to fragmentation of the giant component even more quickly. It should be said that the black-green, these are not, in all cases, in order to compare like with like. Of course, in the model here, in the empirical data, what you've got is you've not got pure contraction. You've got contraction with some regrowth, because you've got the newcomer firms entering in and attaching by preferential attachment. so the, when we talk here about random deletion as targeted deletion, in each of these cases, we've added in this regrowth process in the same way that it's added in the model here. So it's a, which if you didn't, these things would collapse even faster. So in some sense, these things, when we say targeted deletion, this is targeted deletion with some regrowth following preferential attachment, ditto for these other lines. So in some sense, that was the, going from the specific to the more general, that was the first sort of interesting observation that we have entirely idiosyncratic reasons for being able to motivate why these sorts of links might be preserved in this particular system. But it then turns out that actually, in terms of the overall structure of the network and the network robustness, preserving that kind of link is actually quite important. And if you try to break up the network in any other way, it fragments very, very rapidly. So in some sense, that's point three here, that we started putting this in purely based on the very specific context that it seems to actually, if you then try other ways of selecting which links to eliminate, you very quickly find, and of course it has to be said, this is for starting from a disassortative network. But starting from a disassortative network, this seems to be quite important. Moving in a random order, I suppose the observed robustness of the network topology that we saw, so things like the degree distribution and how stable that remain, seem quite interesting and surprising. That's why we have termed as robust contraction. Obviously, there's this feeling that this is something that could be extended beyond this very specific example. And also it raises interesting questions that, for instance, again, in food webs, people have asked for quite some time whether assembly and disassembly processes are in fact symmetric. It would certainly seem to be in this case that they're not symmetric and that there are very significant differences. So assembly and disassembly, so disassembly is not just assembly run backwards in time. The obvious sort of point that probably in many cases we want to be able to combine these sort of contraction and growth models, or for instance switching processes between contracting networks to growing networks. And then the final thing is that everything I've told you so far is entirely simulation based. We're trying to now sort of in certain limits, right, produce analytic results, but actually when you're dealing with a contracting network where the endpoint is that the thing is gone, there's actually quite a few technical problems in doing that. But obviously, we think that's very important, and sort of analytic results for these sorts of networks are very much needed. And so if anybody else has ideas about that, would be great. Some extensions, and I'm not going to be able to do this justice. So one of the things, so coming back to the simplification that we were lumping all of things together. So one of the extensions of this that we have done is by now actually treating the species differently. And one way you can say that is you've got buyers, and you've got sellers, and you've got a small network where buyers and sellers. It actually looks very different than an ecological network because the proportion of those in the middle, the buyers and sellers, is actually only 5% of the population, which is a complete reverse. That's normally in an ecosystem, that's where you'd expect the bulk of the population to actually sit. And what we have done, and this I will just sketch out, is essentially starting from the niche model, which of course is quite successful in creating static versions of ecological networks, by assuming that essentially there's a rank ordering of the number of sellers that a buyer can service, and you're able to come up with a model where the only input are the number of species and the number of links. And of course now what you're talking about is a directed network. And you find that model, so it's a parameter-free model, is very good in reproducing how, for instance, the in and out degree distribution changes over time. Also looking at things like the maximal nestedness sort of parameters. We're now looking some what's not on here is also looking at motifs and sort of smaller scale structures that tend to play a highly significant role in this. So this is a model. The good thing about this model is it disaggregates the different species. It now deals with the directedness of the network. But the problem at the moment is it's not really, what you're able to do is at different points in time, you're able to assemble a network based on very simple rules, which matches the empirically observed network to an amazing degree. And then, but the problem, of course, is that that's not how the network itself evolves. The network evolves from point T1 to point T2, not by totally disassembling itself and then reassembling itself at later. So in some sense, this is what we really have is a kind of a constraint on the real dynamic model, and the real dynamic model is something that we actually still need to find. And then very briefly, another thing that what we've looked at in this context is, so one question is when we're looking at the robustness of the network, how robust are communities? And then also looking at things like connectivity roles, et cetera, and how well does the model reproduce both the communities and the connectivity roles, which it seems to be do quite well. And that's both interesting in terms of model validation, but it's also interesting because in a network like this, you would expect that community structure is actually quite important. And it's interesting to then look what it corresponds to in terms of, for instance, industry specialization, geography, and so on. And then finally, the other obvious extensions to this kind of work are by dealing with the fact that it's a weighted network. So for instance, one of the things, if you look at the weighted cumulative degree distribution, it's much smoother actually, and it loses much of the exponential cutoff. And also now looking at looking at various network metrics in their weighted forms, but also most importantly, an interest in essentially two different sorts of things. Processes on the network, so timing of processes like payments on the network and the extent to which you can actually see the time evolution of those. But also, in the sociological literature, there's a suggestion that there be a big structural difference between what are considered embedded and market links. So links that are created purely transactionally and links that reflect an underlying social structure. And so one other question here, and unfortunately, because the yellow lines sort of become a complete blur, you can't see anything, but that's typical for most network pictures, so I guess it doesn't matter. It is exactly the question of if one looks at sort of persistent structure versus short-term structures, are there differences that correspond to what people believe they would see? And then in closing, just various people, both in Northwestern, which is where most of our collaborators are, and in Oxford.